I want to throw the entire Oklahoma delegation to him at the convention. He won't make it to the convention. He'll be wiped out by Super Tuesday, maybe by the New Hampshire primary.
If you knew him, you wouldn't feel that way, said Senator Thornton.
He's just a hick from the sticks, Senator. A rube from Nowheresville.
That's what they thought in Dallas and Houston, she replied, and in Austin, but he won. He beat them all and won the governorship, and he can win the White House with the proper backing.
No way.
She stopped walking and turned to face O'Brien. His face was dripping sweat. He seemed to be visibly melting like a snowman in the sun. Denny, I'm flying to Tulsa tomorrow night. Come and join me there. Meet the man. Is that asking too much?
O'Brien gave her a mistrustful look. While many in Washington thought that Senator Thornton's physical appearance was her greatest asset, O'Brien and a handful of other insiders knew that the senator's ability to convince people, her skill at changing the minds of erstwhile opponents, was the true key to her success. Overnight? He asked warily.
I'll be gone for the weekend. One day in Tulsa to keep my home fences mended, and then at home at the ranch.
I'll come to the ranch, O'Brien said. Okay?
Fine, she said.
Great. Now let's get out of this sun. O'Brien stalked off toward the nearest bar.
Matagorda Island, Texas.
As Dan walked along the catwalk from his one-room apartment to his office and the breakfast tray that April would have waiting for him, he saw Passo coming in from the morning sunlight through the hangar's big open sliding double doors. The FAA inspector already had his jacket off and folded neatly over one arm. With his free hand, he slowly unknotted his bow tie and unbuttoned his collar as he stood there staring at the wreckage of the spaceplane on the hangar floor. From this distance, it was hard to see the expression on Passo's face, but from the slump of his shoulders, the man seemed to be downcast, depressed. Dan forgot about going to his office and clattered down the steel steps to reach Passo's side.
It's so heartbreaking, Passo said once he recognized Dan. I hate to see the wreckage of a plane. It saddens me.
Come with me, Dan said. I'll show you something that'll cheer you up.
Passo followed Dan without argument, back into the burning brightness of the summer morning. Dan felt the warmth of the sun soaking through his short-sleeved shirt.
We can make electrical energy out of you, he said silently to the sun. We can use your energy to light up the world.
Where are we going? Passo asked, walking beside Dan.
Pointing to Hangar B, a huge metal box looming a few dozen yards from them, Dan replied,
Right there.
This hangar's sliding doors were shut, but there was a man-sized doorway in the nearer of them, with an armed security guard standing just inside it, in the shade.
Hi, Mr. Randolph, said the guard, smiling.
He was portly, jowly, looked out of condition, but he wore a 9mm pistol on his hip.
Morning, Frank, Dan said. This is Dr. Passo. He's with the FAA.
Passo fingered the ID card he wore on a cord around his neck, and the guard peered at it.
Dr. Passo, the guard drawled.
Right.
It took a moment for their eyes to adjust to the much lower light level inside the hangar. And then Passo sucked in his breath.
So that's it, he said almost in a whisper.
That's it, said Dan.
Sitting in the middle of the hangar floor was a sleek, silvery, stub-winged spaceplane, the twin of the one that had crashed. A single tail fin flared up from its rear end, atop a pair of rocket nozzles. Its nose was pointed like a stiletto, with a raked-back windshield above it showing where the cockpit was. The spaceplane rested on three wheels, two where the stumpy wings joined the fuselage, the third beneath the nose.
Passo slowly walked around it, admiration clear in his eyes, his expression. He reached out his free hand and touched the smooth metal skin like a worshiper touching a statue in a cathedral.
Hey, yo! Hands off!
A deep voice bellowed. Passo jerked his hand away as if it had been scalded.
Dan saw a skinny black man in spanking white coveralls advancing from the shadows beneath the catwalk balcony, his dark face scowling.
Don't touch the hardware, man.
Claude, this is my chief technician, Niles Muhammad. Niles, this is Dr. Passo of the Federal Aviation Administration.
Mohammed's demeanor changed by a fraction. Pleased to meet you, Dr. Passo. But please keep your hands off O2.
I'm sorry, Passo apologized. I should have known better.
Niles is the head honcho in this hangar, Dan explained. Nobody lifts a finger in here without Niles knowing about it.
It's a beautiful creation, Passo said, gesturing toward the space plane.
It's almost ready to fly, said Dan.
Another week, Mohammed said. Maybe 10 days. We're checking everything twice, just like Santa Claus.
Good, Dan said. Passo said nothing. He simply stared admiringly at the backup space plane.
Come on, Claude, Dan said at last. Time to get back to work.
Mohammed nodded approvingly. He didn't like having strangers poking around in his hangar. Or the boss, either, for that matter.
He's not such a bad guy, Randolph thought as he watched Passo getting involved deeper and deeper with Joe Tenney in a discussion of the crash investigation.
The telemetry data is pretty clear, Tenney was saying, pointing to a jagged series of spiky lines weaving across his desktop screen.
The forward attitude jets fired, Passo murmured, nodding.
But they weren't programmed to fire at that point, Tenney said, his fingers pecking at the keyboard. See, this is the program on the left, and on the right's the actual.
Passo stared at the screen as intently as if it were the Mona Lisa. Or a Playboy centerfold, Dan thought.
He had taken the FAA official down to Tenney's office, where Passo could compare notes with the beefy engineer on the crash investigation. Tenney had complained that so many people from the FAA, the NTSB, and half a dozen other government agencies were crawling over Astro's headquarters that he was spending all his time babysitting the red tape gang. Yet it had to be done. You don't have a crash, especially a fatal one, without government hounds sniffing everywhere. Even NASA had sent in a team of advisors, although the space plane was strictly a private endeavor. Dan had ordered Tenney to cooperate fully with the investigators. Reluctantly, the engineer turned over most of his tasks to his top aide, Lynn Van Buren, and devoted himself full-time to working with Passo and the other government people. Tenney's office was the opposite of Randolph's, almost exactly the same size, but as neat and ordered as Randolph's was cluttered. The only thing out of place was a painter's easel standing in the far corner of the room, a half-finished acrylic of a tropical beach at sunset done in bold, blaring primary colors. As soon as the two of them began talking technical details, Passo's demeanor, his entire personality, had changed. In my office he's a bureaucrat, winding red tape around my dead body, Randolph said to himself. But here, with Joe, he's an engineer trying to figure out what the hell went wrong with the flight.
May I see the high magnification video again? Passo asked.
It's pretty grainy, Tenney said, as he grabbed the computer's mouse in a meaty hand.
Yes, I know. But I want to see that pitch-down maneuver. Perhaps the video can be enhanced enough to show the puff from the attitude jet.
Tenney nodded, impressed.
Yeah, come to think of it.
Randolph got up from the chair Tenney had given him, thinking, better to leave these two alone. The longer Passo's with Joe, the less he'll bother me.
Gentlemen, Dan said, if you'll excuse me, I have a business to run.
They barely acknowledged his exit, their heads together as they watched the video of the space plane's breakup. Dan couldn't stand to watch it again. Glad to be out of there, Dan pulled his cell phone from his pants pocket and checked his schedule. Meeting with his public relations director at 10. It was a few minutes past the hour, he saw. Hurrying down the hallway, mumbling greetings to the employees he passed, he saw the PR director ambling up from the opposite direction toward him. Len Kinski was a tall, gangling native of New York, where he had worked as an editor and writer for technical magazines for several years. He had left the city in the middle of a nasty divorce proceeding and accepted a job in the boondocks, as he put it, because he needed more money than a journalist made to pay for his divorce lawyer and his ex-wife's constant demands. But although he had taken himself out of New York, he could not take the New York out of himself. He prided himself on being a native of the Big Apple. At least once a day he declared to anyone who would listen that the entire state of Texas wasn't worth a single block of Manhattan's worst slum.
He had absolutely no faith in rockets, no interest.